This webcast is made possible in part by support from the listener members of the Classical Network, WWFM and WWFM.org. Thank you for your support. Cadenza, winner of the Deems Taylor Virgil Thompson Award for Broadcasting, is a production of the Classical Network. Funding for this program is made possible by the listener members of the Classical Network. I'm David Ozenberg, your host. We continue the series called A Summer Celebration of Women and chat with someone who just seems naturally to fit this series for any female classical musician, but especially women composers. There have been many barriers and glass ceilings. And this week we'll conclude our chat with one of America's preeminent composers, Ellen Taafe Zwillich. She was the first woman to receive a doctoral degree in composition from the Juilliard School, the first woman to receive the Pulitzer Prize in Music for her Symphony No. 1 back in 1983, and was named the inaugural holder of the composer's chair at Carnegie Hall in the 90s. And it is that decade where we begin today. Last week we heard how, born in Miami, Florida, she attended a very enlightened high school that led to studies eventually in New York City at the Juilliard School with Elliot Carter and Roger Sessions. She first came to the Big Apple as a violinist, playing in the American Symphony Orchestra under Leopold Stokowski and Gunther Schuller. Her early compositions were atonal expressions, but she changed course, in part as a response to the loss of her husband back in 1979, Joseph Zwillich, also an accomplished violinist. After the Pulitzer, commissions and recognition poured in, and she found her stride in works for orchestra and various chamber combinations. She also received popular recognition when she was mentioned in a Peanuts comic strip, which led to the work you're hearing, her Peanuts Gallery for piano and orchestra, each movement named after and musically portraying one of the beloved characters as created by Charles Schulz. You listen to Movement 1, Schroeder's Beethoven Fantasy, of course quoting the great composer. You're now listening to Movement 3, Snoopy Does the Samba, and then we'll hear the final and sixth movement, Patty and Marcy Lead the Parade. Jeffrey Beagle is the pianist and the Florida State University Symphony Orchestra is led by Alexander Jimenez. My guest's success over her long career, she just turned 80 a few months ago, has made her one of the most recognized and sought-after composers in the classical music world. I spoke with her at her New York apartment a few weeks back. Thank you. To the 90s, you got another first kind of, I think, not only first for a female composer, but American composer, the late, great Charles Schulz. Here's your music.
Oh, God, yeah. Oh, but wait a minute. Go back just a minute.
Okay,
because you talked about the American Symphony.
Yeah.
When I came to New York in the 60s, Stokowski had started the American Symphony, and it was open. There were women, there were Asians, there were blacks. It was an open door at a time when almost, you know, all of the major orchestras, they were 99% white European males.
Right.
And so I just happened to be in the right place at the right time, a number of times.
Yeah.
And that was a huge difference, because when you think about, now you look at, I saw a video of Stokey conducting the Chicago Symphony like 2 years before I got in the American Symphony. And he looked exactly the way he did, the whole nine yards. But when the camera panned the orchestra, it was almost all white European males.
Yeah.
So I walked into a possible situation that turned out to be a very important part of my background. You know?
I used to teach a course at the University of Delaware, and for the final I'd shown the Beethoven Ninth video with Bernstein with the Vienna Phil, which is 1980.
Yeah.
But that was the last bastion, right? It was the camera pan. There's no women.
No.
That was up for both, you know. You know, you say right place, right time. You're right place, right time, but you also had the talent and the assurity to grab that moment. And
well, I had mentors.
Yeah.
And I had people that understood that I had this passion for it,
right.
You know, and they wanted to help. But this thing with the Charles Schulz.
Yes,
thing,
and
that
you heard
was,
your music.
That was, yes.
And you turned up, I mean, it's right up here on the wall, we just passed it, you have it framed, but you turned up in a Peanuts comic strip.
Yeah.
Where Peppermint Patty says...
Yeah, good going, Ellen.
Good going, Ellen, after hearing your food concerto.
The Philadelphia Orchestra was playing my third symphony in Saratoga one summer, and after the concert, a car full of musicians drives by and says, good going, Ellen, you know, it's like... That had the most legs you could possibly imagine.
Well,
and I always say I was very lucky that I read the Times. It doesn't have comic strips in it. And we were away for the weekend. And when I got back, my old answering machine had so many messages. And about the fourth one in, didn't just say, oh my goodness, I saw it, you know. But, but the fourth one in says, you may not know this, but you're in today's Peanuts cartoon. So I ran down to the, you know, garbage room and found the New York Post or Daily News and looked at it. And sure enough, and I always said, I'm lucky I didn't open the paper and just see that, because I probably would have died of a heart attack.
But it's really fun and it's really cool. You know,
it's unbelievable.
You're immortalized.
Unbelievable.
And again, I can't think of many American composers quoted at a Peanuts comic.
No. And,
you know?
And then it went further, because the thing you saw out there, I wanted to write him a note.
Right.
And at any rate, he wrote back and said he wanted to meet me someday. You know, it's like, wow. And then he sent me that. That's the original. The cells are very big. I never knew that.
Oh, wow.
But that's an original cartoon signed by Schulz.
Then
when I got to the composer's chair at Carnegie Hall, we decided the first thing I should do would be a family concert piece, because that had never been done, and I'd never done one. And that's how we got to Peanuts Gallery.
Where each movement is a musical portrait
of a character.
One of Schultz's iconic characters with their personalities. And which leads me to two more points about your music, because in that piece it just makes sense that Schroeder's always playing Beethoven, that you're quoting Beethoven in the work. But there's been other pieces, the Concerto Grosso, it's you and Handel going back and forth and trying to gain the floor. the Millennium Fantasy has the folk song.
That my grandmother sang.
Yeah. So quoting, I mean, it's not a common thread, but you have used older material, quoted parody older material. And you come from a generation, or just at the end of that generation, of composers who, you know, that was, you didn't touch that. I mean, you didn't dare quote something and put it in there. Something recognizable in your music that was not yours. And I mean, so,
I
know.
When
no
somebody tells me, I always say, when somebody tells me I can't do it, it makes me want to do it.
Did somebody ever tell you, no, don't quote any other
You
music?
Can't, yeah, well, yeah, I've heard that, but I don't pay attention. The thing about, I think so many musicians that I have known over the years will have one Peanuts cartoon on their refrigerator door or something, you know. And the whole idea of Schroeder sitting down to his toy piano and playing the Hummer Clavier Sonata. I mean, it's like, if you're a musician, you look at that, and it's just wonderfully funny. Yeah. So that's why I had to quote the Hummer Clavier, because, I mean, it's in his repertoire, you know. So, but the thing with the Handel is that I was asked, this was the tricentennial Handel, and I was asked if I would write a piece based on a theme of Handel. And as that person finished the sentence, I hear a violin sonata that I played years and years and years before. And I said, I'll call you back. Because I said, if I can go to the piano and not just have the violin part, but remember the figured bass part, I'm going to do it. Hmm. And I don't know how I'm going to do it, but I'm going to do it. And of course, there it was in my head. All those years, I hadn't thought about it, hadn't heard it, hadn't played it in many, many years. So that's why I did that.
Sidelight, when I mentioned how I taught some music at University of Delaware, one was like a music appreciation class to kids who were not going into music.
Yeah.
But the textbook we used in 20th Century Music had that piece an example of using older music and 20th Century Music.
Yeah.
But what was great, it was they had a little tiny snippet of a Clara Schumann piece in the Romantic chapter. But that was their first encounter with music by a female composer, but only the third encounter by an American composer in the book.
And so it was
great. And a living composer. All three, boom, boom, boom.
So here are the first two movements of the five-movement Concerto Grosso to Handel's Sonata in D. The Louisville Orchestra is led by James Sedaris, music of my guest today, Ellen Taith Zwillick.
Thank you. Thing is, Peanuts Gallery, Millennium Fantasy, those are kind of, strangely enough, it's the pieces for piano and orchestra. Those are outliers because everything else has traditional genre titles, symphonies, there's concertos.
Oh, I write the piece and then I think, oh, what am I going to call it?
Anyway. Yeah, a lot of your concertos are for instruments that sadly need repertoire, which is great. But if you look at your upcoming performances, it's trios and quintets and quartet. So, I mean, just using these traditional genre names, you know, why, and that is it that you don't want to put something in the audience's head of a pre-notion before they hear a note, or is it just you're comfortable in that?
Well, I tell you the truth, you know, my first symphony was originally called Three Movements for Orchestra.
Yeah.
And I had started that without any prospects of performance. And I kind of got this last-minute call from the American Composers Orchestra, and they, can you have a piece by, and I said, yes, you know. And I was able to finish it, and I was copying the parts. I mean, this goes back to, hand copying, which I hated, but I had to learn how to do it well. And I'm actually in Pittsburgh. I was there for a performance of something else, but I was staying at somebody's house, and I didn't even go out because I'm copying all these parts, and I didn't have a title. And I got a call from a woman that I knew from the American Symphony, in whom I know today, she lives over like three blocks away, Nancy Shear. She said, we're going to press with the program. And what is your title? I said, I don't have a title. She said, well, you got to give me a title. And she was a friend, you know. So I said, well, it's in three movements and it's for orchestra. So call it Three Movements for Orchestra.
Wildly descriptive.
And, of course, this was at a time when, you know, the word symphony had, you know, like, people got all excited and upset and whatever.
Right, right, right.
Anyway, when we got into the rehearsals, Gunther Schuller was the conductor, and he got me over in the first rehearsal and said, you know, this is really a symphony. I said, I know it is, but I didn't want to deal with it, you know, 3 weeks ago when I...
Right.
So he said, it's really a symphony. And so I said, okay, so let's call it that. But I get very disappointed sometimes when I go to a concert and I love the title of a piece. And then I don't like the piece.
Doesn't add up to the title.
So I really don't care what I call a piece. I mean,
when you get feedback, either it's from somebody you know, trust, a performer, or someone who knows music, or a complete, you know, unknown audience member, when they say, hey, this music reminds me of, I mean, does that ever resonate with you?
No, but I must say I wrote a ballet for the Tallahassee Youth Orchestra and Youth Ballet. And I didn't have a title for it. And so the conductor and I decided, let's let the kids have a little contest. So we had a little contest of what you're going to call this. And one of the kids came up with the Celestial Ballet. And each movement had, you know, some kind of an astronomical thing. I loved it. So I went with that. But
that's cool.
So my guest, Elintef Zulik, has composed five numbered symphonies. The fifth has no commercial recording yet. The fourth sets texts and is for orchestra and adult and children's choruses. But here, once again, is the Louisville Orchestra, led by James Sedaris, in the second movement from the three-movement Third Symphony from 1992.
Thank you. you look at your big output, you've written a few pieces for voice, some for chorus, chorus and orchestra. What you won't find is what you've been trenchant about for decades and decades, and that is at the opera.
Yeah.
Still there? Just or,
oh, no, I don't want to write an opera.
No, don't want to.
I love opera.
Yeah.
And I used to play in the stage band at the Met, so, and my late husband played at the Met.
Right.
And I had an opportunity, a very good opportunity to write an opera. And I went to Pittsburgh for the performance of my first symphony, the three movements for orchestra. And I had heard it a few times and had gotten a little more relaxed.
Yeah.
And I'm sitting there and I'm thinking, literally, I have died and gone to heaven. This is like my dream. And I went back and I turned down the opera commission. And there's just so much that goes into it. And I had thought at one point, if I did want to write an opera, I'd like take a year off and go live at an opera house and, you know, the whole thing. But the way things are today, the stage director, you know, is very often the person who determines, you know, what's going to go on. And it's just not my cup of tea. Although I do like the opera. I like it.
Yeah, I mean, there's just been so many changes to opera just in the last 10 years, 15 years with the technology of what they're able to do. And it's not whiz-bang gadget stuff. It's creating whole new ways to create an opera and where it lives and how people see it and all that stuff. I didn't know if maybe your mind starts saying, well, maybe I could do a chamber thing.
No, I don't want to do it.
I know, you have things in the back of your head.
I don't want to do it. I must say that I have seen a couple of the broadcasts when I was like down in Florida. And the wonderful thing is when you go to intermission and they show what's going on backstage. Because I used to say that, you know, it's like, here I am backstage, ready to play. There's a couple singing to one another on the stage.
Yeah.
And back here, somebody's hammering, somebody else is doing electrical work, and somebody who's performing later and needed to do it is doing push-ups. And I mean, it was just really like a zoo of things going on with costumes and hair and, you know, all of this sort of thing. And I always thought, that's more interesting
than
some of the stuff on stage.
I agree. It makes more sense than some of the stuff on stage. I just wondered, because, you know, I didn't know if there was something in the back of your head. I mean, another composer who, for 7 months before you reached the 4-score mark, you know, Joan Tower for years, no vocal music, and finally she broke down and did a few things, so I didn't know. Maybe that was in her head. She got asked by certain people, you know, Dawn Upshaw said, please write me something. So I didn't know. You know, maybe it's time has come or something. But, okay.
No, I don't want to write an opera.
Yeah.
And, I mean, it's not a mean, negative thing. I just don't want to do it.
And it can be a real love-hate relationship with composers with opera. They either just fall right into it.
And also, it's a different, I mean, Strauss, you know, he could walk and chew gum.
Right.
However, you can't compare Rosenkavalier and Elektra and Salome to his instrumental music. His instrumental music is very, very good, but his heart and soul was in the theater.
Yeah.
You know, I think there are composers whose heart and soul is in the theater. Verdi, or, you know, Puccini. And those are the composers who seem to me to do opera best.
Right.
If it's your love, it's not a job, you know.
Yeah.
It's a love.
And it's a huge time commitment. You have to deal with a lot of cooks in the kitchen type of thing, that whole mentality. Anyway, just curious.
Sorry.
There are a few vocal or choral works by my guest, here from 1981, not long after the death of her husband, are the final movements from a work titled Passages. We'll listen to Self-Portrait, Interlude, and Way to Go. The Ensemble 21 is led by Arthur Weisberg, the voice of soprano Anne DeVries, music by Ellen Tafe Zwillick.
Thank you.
You've done what I'm doing with you. You've done interviews in the past with some pretty big-name composers. I can't duplicate your list because some of these guys kicked the bucket before the show started. But, I mean, you did Boulez and you did Morton Gould and David Diamond. I never got to Elliot Carter. You did Lucas Foss. I have done Ned Roram, and I had Gunther Schuller around the first year of this program where he talked a half an hour about how the St. Matthew Passion was the first great piece of contemporary music. But anyway, so why did you do this? What did you get out of
it? Well, you know what you just said.
Yeah.
These people are no longer with us. I mean, Ned is, but that's about it.
Yeah.
And me.
Yeah.
That was my idea, because when I went to Carnegie Hall, Judith Aaron was an absolutely wonderful CEO of Carnegie. She was a real musician and a lover of music, but she was a sharp business person too. And we talked about the fact that that world moves slowly, in a sense, because things are planned 2, 3, 4 years ahead. So we were thinking of things that I might do in addition to, like, writing something. And I said, you know, is there any kind of a record of first performances at Carnegie Hall? And they had done one for an anniversary not long before that. So I got this list, and I'm looking at this, and Tchaikovsky on opening night. Then you get a little further, the Dvorak, and on and on. I get into the 30s, and the first name I saw of somebody that was a friend of mine, Morton Gould.
Yeah.
And Dimitri Metropoulos had really championed Morton. And most of the history with composers at Carnegie Hall up until rather recently, about 20 years ago when I was there, was with the New York Philharmonic. So there were quite a number of premieres and things. And so I started seeing names of people I knew. And I thought, well, we can't talk to Tchaikovsky, we can't talk to Dvorak, but we can talk to Morton Gould, we can talk to Lucas Foss, we can talk to on and on and on. So that's why I did that. And it's available through the Library of Congress now. Yeah. It's digitized. And it was a really remarkable experience. And there were two things about it that I always mention. One is that, of course, my idea would be to the composer and I would be sitting in a box at Carnegie looking out on the stage, you know, and that was terribly expensive. You know, just to walk in with a camera was like $10,000, and then there's rehearsals and so on. So we're walking all around Carnegie Hall trying to figure out a good place to do it. We got to the archives, and I said, this is perfect. And I was there with the videographer, the house manager, and the artistic administrator. And the videographer said, I don't like the color. And the house manager said, what color do you want me to paint it? And that was what I had. And I had originally thought it'd be like, you know, the Yale oral history. Yeah. And Judy Aaron said, let's do a video.
I was thinking.
And she was a very forward-thinking person. Anyway, so we did it in the archives. And one of the interesting things was that over this, just the few years that we did this, it kind of tended to move from filing cabinet to computer. It was very interesting, and I considered it like the armature of the interview. We had the history of the composer at Carnegie Hall. We had programs and pictures and all this sort of thing. But people could talk about anything they wanted to talk about.
Right.
And I only had two rules. One, we were up on right on 57th Street. We don't stop for ambulances and fire, you know, sirens. Yeah. We just keep talking. We don't stop if somebody's mic falls off. You just go over and put it back on, and we keep going. We only stopped for, in those days it was a videotape, when they had to change the tape. That's all, the only time we stopped. You know, all of those wonderful little ventures outside of the meat of what we were talking about. Fascinating. I loved doing that. They were like between 2 and 3 hours.
Well,
and
thanks for doing those. I mean,
it was,
you know,
it was a wonderful experience for me. I loved it.
Yeah, I've done the same over the years here. When I you know, if a siren goes by, I just leave it.
Yeah, let it go.
Figure John Cage would be proud of me.
So in case you missed it when I played it on her 80th birthday back in April, here is the final movement from Ellen Tafe Zwillich's Concerto for Bass, Trombone, Strings, Timpani, and Cymbals. The soloist is Charles Vernon, the Michigan State University Symphony Orchestra is led by Leon Gregorian. Thank you.
Last thing, and it's to wrap up the interview, I'm going back to an interview you did about 30 plus years ago, and the quote was from you.
30 years ago.
Yeah, in the 80s. It says, "I have more than a lifetime of things that I want to write."
Yeah.
Still true.
Oh, absolutely.
Still going. Can you?
Yeah, I say that the day I get up and I don't feel that I have a passion for what I'm doing, I quit. I mean, I'm not saying that every day is a wonderful day. I mean, there are days when you feel like, you know, throwing the computer out the window or something. But I basically love what I'm doing, and I feel just privileged to be able to do it. So I keep going.
Okay. I know some composers are superstitious or whatever.
Anything
you're doing that you can mention or not?
I'm writing something. A recent piece is... hasn't been performed yet. A cello concerto, which is something I wanted to do for a long time.
Yeah.
And the piece I'm writing right now, it's a chamber piece, but if I get started, I will wear out your machine. So I can't talk about it. Really.
Most of your concertos have had a soloist in mind, right? That you've written for?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Which has been a part of it.
Yeah.
Because it's been thrilling to me. And I've written a bassoon concerto, and I always say, I not only don't know how to play it, I don't know why anybody would, you know. And it's like, there's just so many things about it, the instrument, that are difficult. They have to make the reed. It's made of wood and cork and all of this. But I had a wonderful, wonderful time with Nancy Garris, who's a principal in Pittsburgh, whom I wrote it for. And the people that I have worked with, most of them have given me wonderful advice. And I will talk to them about the repertoire that they have and how they feel about it. And I always say, you can tell me I hate such and such a piece, and my lips are sealed. I would never tell anybody what you said. And but I really have had very nice relationships with people.
We started to talk about your birthday. On your birthday, I played your music on the air, and I played your bass trombone concerto.
Oh my God!
I can't find another bass trombone concerto that's as good as yours. So. Yeah,
and Charlie Vernon, this was for Chicago.
Yeah,
Symphony, and Charlie Vernon was incredible virtuoso.
Yeah.
And he was just so much fun to work with, because he would record stuff And he would play something and he'd say, I can do this or that, and this is an example of that. And on one of the tapes, his wife walked into the room and said, Charlie, are you all right? But we had a lot of back and forth, and it was just wonderful. And I was able to do things that you would never have imagined would be possible.
But, well, I just think he was thrilled someone was writing a bass trombone.
He was just, and he nailed the thing. I mean, he just was wonderful. I love him.
Well, many more years of writing.
Thank you.
I close all my cadenza interviews by asking my guests the same two quick questions. So the first question is a hypothetical, which is if you could chat like we've been chatting, but, and you've met a lot of people in your life, but with someone from the past who you never had a chance to talk to or interview, but could. When I ask that, what's the first name? If you think about it, you can get kind of swamped with names. But
Haydn.
It would be Haydn.
And that's because of all the composers, the historical list of composers, he's the guy you'd like to go out and have a cup of coffee with.
Huh.
And he was a wonderful, wonderful person. I mean, he was 27 years older than Mozart, and he was a mentor of him and a supporter. I think his music is wonderful and also very influential, but he's just like the guy you'd like to have met.
He was supposedly impeccably dressed in Queen Eo.
Probably.
He was very fastidious about how he looked and very kind. Well, we had a whole conversation of firsts. I've had everything to that question from God to Groucho Marx, and of course when it's a composer, Bach is the runaway number one answer.
Yeah.
A lot of conductors pick Mahler, blah, 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 blah. You're the first person in 14 years that has picked poor Haydn, Haydn. So congratulations on picking Haydn.
Well, I've known a lot of the 20th century.
Yeah.
And I had a little intersection with Shostakovich.
Wow,
and I played in a whole concert of Kachaturian's
music.
Yeah,
you did.
You know, I knew a lot of the major figures
in
the 20th century music.
Final question.
Yeah.
It's a non-musical question.
Okay.
Everybody I interview at Cadenza fills their life with music. You've filled life and you're still busy. We're sitting right next to your keyboard, composing room. When you have to get away from music, pleasure, relaxation, enjoyment, what do you do if you need a respite just to pull yourself away?
Well, I'm in the pool every day.
Oh.
That's a big deal for me. And I love to travel and go unusual places and not be in a group.
Yeah.
And I love good food and wine, and I don't know. There's a lot of life to enjoy.
And a lot more for you. Thanks, Ellen Zwillick. Thanks.
Thank you.
Composer Ellen Tafe Zwillick. You can find out more about her at her website, Zwillick, Zwillich.com. Her music appears on many recordings on many different labels. Check it out, though don't wait on that opera. Speaking of opera and my summer Celebration of Women series, next week I'll speak with the 2019 Pulitzer Prize winner, the fourth woman to win the prize in the past 6 years, and it's been 36 years since my guest today broke that barrier. We'll chat with Ellen Reed, who won the prize for her first opera that deals with sexual abuse and its aftermath, called Prism. Since my guest these past 2 weeks has had a career that calls for it, I'll leave you with the closing minutes of her 1985 work simply titled Celebration, composed for Andre Previn when he assumed leadership of the Los Angeles Philharmonic Orchestra. Here it is played by the Indianapolis Symphony Orchestra, led by John Nelson. Music of my guest today, Ellen Tafe Zwillick. And as always, I'm glad you're in the audience today, and I hope you'll join me here each week for a chat with the great classical musicians of our area and the globe. Remember, you can listen to any recent past Cadenza program by going to wwfm.org and clicking on Classical and then Webcasts. I ask you to please support this and the many specialty programs we offer by making your donation today at our website. Thank you, and thanks for listening. I'm David Ozenberg, and this has been the award-winning Cadenza, an exclusive production of the Classical Network and wwfm.org.